Good evening. My name is Rob, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Rob.
Welcome to the Tuesday night Big Book work group meeting. The format of this meeting is to closely examine the program of recovery as outlined in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We hope that this experience will motivate you into an active participation in the working or reworking of the 12 steps as outlined in the text. Some of the things we study tonight may go at odds with what many of us have believed about AA recovery and what it means to be an AA member. This is not meant to be an indictment of anybody's sobriety or experience, but we do suggest that you have an open mind on the subject material covered tonight and be open to a new experience with the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. There should be copies of the text in the back if you need one. The books are $6. I've got them up here. I've got the soft covered and I've got the new fourth edition. Throw the money in the basket along with your dollar, if you could. The group celebrates anniversaries at the end of each quarter. We're celebrating celebrants for January, February, and March at the end of this month. We only have two people in the book. If anybody wants to celebrate, please do so. Do we have any other AA-related announcements? Didn't think so. I forgot to ask anybody to read what is AA, so I'll read it. What is AA? Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problems and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. It does not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. May I? This group also has a Big Book discussion meeting here on Saturday nights at 6 o'clock. May I show a hands for people who are willing to clean up afterwards? Thanks. We could really use your help. This meeting runs an hour and 15 minutes and ends at 9:15. If anyone needs to get up and move around, please do so quietly. If you have pagers or cell phones, please turn them off or put them into silent mode. We start this meeting with a set-aside prayer, so if we can all take a moment and try to quiet our minds from the thoughts of the day, I will say the prayer. God, we invite you into this room to guide and direct each of us as we seek your truth. Please set aside within each of us that which would block off from the truth. Lay aside our prejudices and what we think we know about the recovery process so that we may be open to a new experience. Remove our fears that we may hear your truth. Give us strength and the courage to share your truth with each other in the real spirit of love and compassion. Amen. Tonight's leader is Rachel, and I believe she's doing steps 7 and 8? 8 and 9?
8 and 9.
8 and 9.
Something like that.
Hi,
everybody. My name is Rachel. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Rachel.
I also share that I'm a food addict, and that's an important part of my recovery as well, but not anything that I will talk about tonight, except to say that this program works in that area of my life as well and has removed the obsession and compulsion. We come in here with a lot of stuff, but God got involved in that area of my life, and I'm very grateful for that as well. God plucked me out of the bar and dropped me into AA, and that's literally the way it felt like on April 1st of 1999. And it really happened, it seems, that quickly, though when I look back, there was a series of events leading up to, I was first introduced to 12-step recovery when I was 17 years old and I was institutionalized for my eating disorder, and it was suggested that perhaps I belonged in AA as well, and it took what it took, and I found my way here in 1999, and God has kept me safe and protected ever since. I love the set-aside prayer, and it was something that was introduced to me when I first started going through the Big Book with somebody. I was really lucky to have this come into my life at 6 months sober. Now, I'm also talking in an area where there's a lot of people at a Big Book meeting, and I come from an area where, we're blossoming. It's happening, but, 7.5 years ago, when I would talk about this stuff, people would just call me a thumper and, look the other way. It wasn't necessarily the way that things happen. So I was real lucky at 6 months. I had had a couple of sponsors. Nobody had ever really taken me through the steps. My first sponsor used to say to me in the morning, I had to call her every morning, part of the discipline of early recovery, and she would tell me in her Irish brogue, you know, spread your wings and float like a butterfly and be free today, you know, and that worked for me for a while in early recovery. I was floating on the hope of the first three steps, that I knew I was powerless over alcohol. I knew that it had made my life totally crazy. I believed that something, you know, could help me with it, and so I would go to meetings and feel better when I left. That mantra worked for me for a little while, and then at probably 3, 4, 5 months, you know, the hope of just coming to AA meetings and seeing people smiling stopped working for me because I was in so much pain. I was doing damage in my life that I, you know, physically acting out at people, my boyfriend at the time, things I had never even done when I was drunk because I just had no tools. I had no way to live. And I remember a woman one time telling me, I think you're ready for your fourth step. And I'm like, okay, so how do you do that? She was like, ask your sponsor. And my, you know, my sponsor just said, spread your wings and float like a butterfly. So a series of events pointed me in the direction of a woman who gave me the number of another woman. And at 6 months, I called this woman up. I had never met her before in my life. She lived 45 minutes from where I did. And I said, I need help. Because at that point, I was ready to die. It wasn't even about drinking. It was just die. You know, I'm done with this. And she told me, come to my house, and I had no idea what I was in for. And the first thing she did with me is she read that set-aside prayer. And that's something that I've carried along with every woman I've had the opportunity to work with. And every time before I speak, and I just think it's a great way to keep myself open to a new experience. So I always pray before I speak that God will remove my ego and just let me share a message that'll be of help to others, because that's my purpose in life now, is to be of maximum service to other people. So that's what my prayer is. Then, you know, I get here, and I've spoken here before. There are some familiar faces, and of course I get here, and I start to get nervous because you see the equipment and the recording, and it's taped. And so I go up in the bathroom, like, what am I going to say? What am I going to say? What am I going to say? And it doesn't matter, because I brought God into it. And I am grateful every day of my life for people that, in the morning or before they go to meetings or before they speak, have said, God speak through me, because that saved my life on occasions, hearing people share in the rooms. And experience, strength, and hope to me have been the tools of God's grace in my recovery. So tonight I'm going to share a little bit about steps 8 and 9, and of course I'll have to talk a little bit also about kind of things leading up to that, just to get some perspective on where I'm coming from. And what time do I have until?
9 o'clock.
Okay.
10.
Yeah.
11.
There are people in the room here who are like, don't tell her that, because she can do that. She'll be here till that time. Anyway, what I learned, I already told you a little bit about 1, 2, 3, like those floating in hope steps. And then when I got to 3 and just made the decision, all right, I'll try this. God's going to run the show. Nothing incredibly major happened in my life. I had already had kind of that early recovery, sobriety, pink cloud, like, oh my God, there's a brook next to my apartment that I've lived in for 2 years and I never noticed it because I was always drunk or recovering. And you know where your car is. But by the end of my drinking, I was checking my car in the morning to see if there was blood or hair or dents or dings, because I was a blackout drinker and I had no idea how my car got home or what may have happened in the interim. I started drinking I had a couple of drunks. I got drunk once when I was 11. I got drunk once when I was 12. And then started drinking when I was 16, going into 17th year. My father is one of us. He calls himself one of us. He ended up in rehab in 1988, and I had decided in my life that I would not be like my father, because we all know the devastation that alcohol causes. We all know what it's like to be, well, I know what it's like to be a child in a house where there's unpredictability, where dad might come through that door and it's going to be great, and we're going to go on vacation tomorrow or maybe tonight. Or dad walks in the house and there's, you know, smashed furniture and scary things. So I had decided I was absolutely not going to be that way. So I had really made a decision not to drink at all. And I was one of those kids in high school that you hated who was like, high on life, I'm high on life. Well, then I started being like high on life and running programs for other kids in schools and kids in elementary school and then going to the parties on the weekends and getting blasted. So when I received the Peer Development Award when I was a senior, you know, the half of the crowd just kind of grinned at me like they knew what my deal was. And I think that the peer counselor leader was quite surprised when the known, you know, druggies stood up and like applauded and screamed and yelled for me as I was getting the Peer Development Award for my assistance in promoting, you know, sober lifestyle. Anyway, I truly believe I was born with the allergy as it's described in the doctor's opinion, because I never drank just one. From the first time I drank, once I would have alcohol in my body, something would happen. I couldn't stop. I don't know where I would end up next. My first blackout happened when I was 17 years old. I came to in a very, you know, awkward, compromising situation. And I was, really blacked out till the end. Now, that doesn't need to be a qualification to be an alcoholic. The book is real clear that you make your own diagnosis. But that was the truth for me. It got really bad really quickly. There were consequences immediately, crashed cars. I was probably in 6 to 9 alcohol-related car accidents over the years. I tended to hit objects as opposed to other cars, which was a good thing, although I did hit a couple of parked cars. I had hit and runs. I had all of this stuff that happened. And every time the cops would show up, somebody from my family would also show up, and they would look the other way. Cops enabled me. AAA was a great enabler. You run the car off the side of the road in the middle of the night, call AAA. They tended to arrive pretty quickly, and the cops never got involved. So needless to say, there was devastation from the beginning. And I'll talk about, you know, the damage that I did to my family. I was unpredictable. I was emotionally, you might want to say kind of on the verge of being psychotic. They never quite knew what was going to come out of me. I usually left family gatherings in tears because of sensitivity. I tended to do really well in school. That was kind of another part of me. If I just did better, I'd feel better. If I just got an A+, you know, I'd be okay. And of course you get that and it still doesn't feel right. I still didn't feel right. So, you know, I'd be getting these awards and doing really well academically, and then the next day, like, totaling the family car. So nothing really to be proud of. My parents were ashamed in the town that I lived in and grew up in as I went from my teen years into my mid-20s, because I was just this public, you know, I drank in bars and I fell down in bars, and it was a real kind of public thing. Everybody knew, all the cops knew my car. My mother worked for the town. She was an administrator for the town, so she was kind of the administrator of the police who were looking the other way as her daughter was, you know, pulling out of the bar, hanging out with known drug dealers and users. I just really, you know, I was nobody to be proud of. And, of course, that was the thing that I always kind of went with. Like, they're not proud of me. They don't tell me they're proud of me. And, you know, how can you be of an active alcoholic who just, you know, has really good intentions but starts drinking and all those good intentions go out the door, you know? So I have a twin sister, and she and I, as you can imagine, identical twins, were pretty tight growing up, best of friends, inseparable. And then in college, when she was part of that high on life thing too, but stayed high on life and not on drinking, we kind of went, you know, drifted. My drinking and escapades damaged her pretty deeply as well. She was married to a police officer. Well, she was engaged at the time to a police officer. She's currently married to one. So anytime the cops showed up at the house at 2 o'clock in the morning looking for me or to bring me home or calling, it's kind of the blue code that if a cop is injured or is killed in the line of duty, that another police officer will come to the home and notify the spouse or the fiancé. So my sister typically got these phone calls, answered the door, and there was the town cop standing there with a terrible look on their face. And to her it was, oh my God, something happened to my fiancé. And of course the answer was always that it was Rachel screwed up again, you know. So I knew that that had caused her a lot of deep damage. I have another brother who is also on the job, and he was the one that was always coming to cover it up when I had, you know, car accidents, several car accidents. He was the one that showed up and, you know, talked them out of even considering giving me, you know, any type of road sobriety test or anything. And I lived with him for a brief while. I was in graduate school and had an internship, and I lived with him kind of part-time and didn't show up when I said I was going to show up, never came home. He'd be driving to the bus station or to the train station looking for my car, calling the bars, looking for me, and I'd come home the next day and have some stupid story. He was one person, though, that I could never believed my lies, you know, and he would just tell me, well, that's why he's a really good cop, too. That's why he does really good interrogations. But he just, there was no, you know, fooling him, and so I was an embarrassment to him. And you know, my other brother lived in the town that I lived in and saw the people I hung out with and the things that I did and, you know, just wouldn't even speak to me, just wouldn't even acknowledge me and would tell me, you're an embarrassment. In high school, I partied with his friends. You know, in my early 20s, I hung out with his friends. So the stories, you know, the devastation of the things that the places we put, the situations I put myself in as a result of my addiction as a woman, I think any alcoholic is a really sad thing, but a drunk woman, it's really devastating. And the places that you come to in and the things that you realize. And sometimes I'm grateful for the blackouts because I don't want to know what happened in some of those times. Well, my brother, you know, my other brother knew, had people telling him about what was happening in those times. So I think I'm painting a really good picture of what my deal was like with my family. And even, in remembering it, ugh, my gosh, no wonder I had to be drunk all the time. I just, you know, can't even imagine that was what they thought of me. God bless you. So my dad, you know, came into the rooms and never, like, came and made amends or did anything like that. And I used to think, you know, well, he's got to come and make it better. He's got to acknowledge it. He's got to do something. And I was really, really angry about a lot of the stuff that had happened when my dad was drinking, when my dad was active. My dad and I didn't speak for a year at one point. He and I would butt heads on everything and anything. And it would be me saying, this cap is blue, and he would say, no, the cap is aqua, and we would fight about that. My drinking, of course, he knew the truth way before I did, and he used to tell me, you got to get honest with you. One day you'll see the truth. And it just used to make me so angry. And, I finally realized what he was talking about. So I came into recovery, and at 6 months, as I mentioned, I started going through these steps. So I had my first experience with 8 and 9. A big part initially, and I'm talking about this, I'm going back and talking about the first inventory that I did, when a lot of it was about that wreckage, about the crashed cars, about the money that I owed, you know, about the embarrassing situations I put myself in my family and in compromising situations. And when my sponsor at the time had led me up to the fifth step and I had done the fifth step, there were some things that I held back on my first, fourth, and fifth step. I came into the rooms very involved in a very, very sick relationship with another active person, an active alcoholic and drug addict. And I met him in the beginning of my bottom and spiraled out of control for the next 9 months along with this guy. And I came into the rooms and my outpatient counselor and my first sponsor said to me, "You got to break up with him. You got to end the relationship." And I was like, okay, because I want this. I really wanted it. He had as much power over me as booze and drugs did. That relationship, I didn't know how to end a relationship with someone that was just as strong, was my master, had me mastered, you know. So as to not fall out of good graces, and a big part of my deal was, you know, people must like me. I have to be the good girl and do what everybody says to do. I just started lying to this woman. I just told her that I ended the relationship and it was over. And it wasn't. And I was in a relationship with an active alcoholic and drug addict as I was in early recovery. And, you know, he would not, the stuff we all do, say I'll see you at 7 o'clock, not come home for 3 days. You know, the craziness, the drama, me throwing him out, taking him back. This went on for 2 years in recovery. There was one person I was honest with, and at the time I justified it and said, I'm being honest with one person, so I'm being honest with God and I'm being honest with myself. But at the time I realized this was someone that kind of co-signed my stuff, you know what I mean? She really wasn't, she had the same amount of sober time as I did. We were in outpatient rehab together. She was a friend, not necessarily someone that was in a position to give me any type of spiritual guidance. So this went on for a while, and in the midst of this, I did my first, fourth, and fifth step. And I inventoried some of that relationship, but I couldn't inventory a lot of it because she didn't think I was in it anymore. Because I wanted to go through the work. I didn't want her to, you know, get rid of me. When it came time to making amends to my family initially, I did this stuff. It talks about, you know, we need more action. And we find that faith without works is dead. I came to believe in the stuff I read up to this point, that I had this fatal illness, that I would die, that I had to do certain things if I wanted to get better. What I bought into more was this was going to be the answer to me finally feeling okay, you know, finally feeling better. God removed the obsession to drink. That wasn't my problem when I started the steps. My problem was the pain of living. And I really bought into the idea that there was hope. There was a whole lot of hope. And I wanted to move on right on, you know, to 8 and 9. So I was very, very willing to do that. And I had, I looked at the harms that I had listed that I had done to other people. And I came in as a saint, you know, really thinking I was the victim, that everybody had done stuff to me. I really didn't expect for my 8th and 9th step to be very long or take very long. And, ooh, I was, you know, definitely mistaken. Because in my 4th step, I really asked God to show me the truth, and God showed me the truth about the damage that I did, and I got to see how all of that stuff I told you about affected people in my life. Not to mention the, you know, list of all the other acquaintances along the way and colleagues and things that I hadn't mentioned. So I made this list, and I was kind of shocked at what I needed to go to people with. And for my family, a lot of it initially was like with my dad, like I owed him money. Owed him money, had to pay him back some money. And my mother, I had totaled her car, two of her cars. So I had to go, you know, about that. So it was a lot of that wreckage of the past kind of stuff. Now, mind you, I went to my brothers and my sister, like I'm working the spiritual program, and this is what I did, and I want to know how it affected you, and how can I make it better? And they weren't too keen on hearing it because they knew that I was with this guy. They knew that I was lying to all of them about it because I had to lie to my family about it too to really keep. I was living with a man. And when my family would come to visit, I would like hide. We would hide all his stuff. You know, I had to make amends to this guy too because of that. You know, what did this poor guy feel like, you know? And he was a collector of, like, NASCAR stuff, so he would have shelves and shelves of NASCAR stuff. And when my parents would come in, I would have to move it all into the closet and put out other things. The lengths I went to, the insanity of kind of keeping that up. Anyway, I'm going to my brothers and my sister talking about how I'm living a spiritual life now and everything's going to be better. And in the meantime, they know that I'm lying about all of this stuff. So my point in that is, you know, we don't just say we're sorry. The amends is about, it's about making it better. It's about living a different life. It's about, for me, it was about getting God involved to really take that stuff away and change the person that I was, have that spiritual awakening so that I could, you know, stop hurting people and stop lying. And that hadn't happened at that point. So my family, needless to say, wasn't too, none of those relationships changed. It didn't change at all. I'm going to fast forward now to a couple years, 2.5 years in the rooms. I finally got honest with my first, she wasn't my first sponsor, but for all intents and purposes, my first sponsor that took me through the work. With the help, God bless you, of some women in the room, I finally got honest with her about the relationship. And what I realized was I had harmed her because I had been lying to her that we had really had this wonderful relationship. This woman spent night after night taking me through the work and, you know, a year and a half of a relationship, and I was doing a lot of lying. So I acknowledged that to her. We kind of decided at that point that enough, you know, there was a lot of damage and that it probably would be better for me to kind of move on and find somebody else. And I found God led me right to a woman that is still my sponsor to this day. And that relationship started in late 2000. And early 2001, she laughed because I remember like dates and numbers and stuff in a very weird way. But I ran a lot in my life, and when I met this woman, the first thing I said to her was, you know, I need to do an inventory on a relationship because I was really ready to get honest about this crazy relationship with this guy. And she said to me, I can't wait to hear it, you know. And I'm like, whoa, you know, wow. I had never heard of this step up to that point, but I can imagine that I was like, oh, I would be dreading hours and hours of, you know, somebody dumping their stuff. And this woman couldn't wait to hear it. And you know, she's my sponsor to this day. I did a lot of bouncing around, a lot of running around, a lot. I had 4 sponsors in my first, like, 3 months of recovery because I'd get a little close and I'd run. And another thing this woman said to me one of the first times we met was, you know, did you ever think that you and I could maybe be forever? So that's something that's really cool because I would just run from people in my life. And she said, you know, she was really ready to hear it. So then I just stopped calling her for a little while and I balked a little bit. I had ended the relationship with this other guy, and of course, ladies, you can fill in the blanks, I got right into a relationship with another guy because I was spiritually sick, and I had this big, huge emptiness inside of me that I needed to fill with something, and I hadn't quite tapped into God yet, so a man would do it. I was very lucky that this was a guy that, you know, God gets our attention in ways that mean something to us, and he came into my life, and I truly believe in looking back that I would not have been able to break free of that relationship had another person not come in. I don't suggest it to anybody, but our experience is our experience, and it takes what it takes. And when that relationship ended, then I was in enough pain that it was time to do the work. And I called up my sponsor, devastated, you know, 10:30 at night. He was leaving, you know, he's leaving me, and that brought up all this stuff. And she said, we talked the next day, and she said, you know, you think maybe you could just kind of give it a shot without a guy. Just get through the work again. Just give it a shot without a relationship. And I was like, okay, but only 90 days. And I, like, circled the date on the calendar, you know, when I could find another man. And I went through the work again, this time totally honest, really bringing God in with a loving sponsor kind of leading the way. And uncovered so much more. I really saw the truth about the stuff I did to my family and the kind of person I was. And more importantly, I really saw that hole, that for me, the black hole. That's my spiritual sickness. It's a black hole that my whole life I look to fill up. You know, give me the food, give me the booze, give me the men, give me whatever. Just fill it up. And a black hole sucks it in, and it just disappears, and it just needs more. And that's just the way. I was a bottomless pit, totally beyond human aid. And that's what I realized in that kind of working through the steps, that no human person could fill that up, no thing could fill that up, that had to come from something greater than me, from a power greater than myself. And when it came to make an amends that next time, I was really, really scared, and I was really, really worried. I just want to backtrack. It talks about in the book, it gives us really good examples of different amends we need to make. It talks about financial amends to make on page 78. It tells us we have to lose our fear of creditors, or we might drink again, a big warning. It talks about criminal offenses. When I went to go make my initial amends, I had three people I had to approach in that first working through the steps that I had mentioned, the devastation of the past. Three people that could have potentially picked up the phone and called the police. And there were no other people involved in that. It was just me. And each of those three people that I went to were quite forgiving. One person I had some financial amends to make to, and the other couple of people who knew me very well were just very happy that I was, doing what I was doing. It gives us real clear instructions if other people are involved. On page 80, there's a drastic warning. It says, before taking drastic action, which might implicate other people, we first secure their consent. If we have obtained permission, have consulted with others, ask God to help, and the drastic step is indicated, we must not shrink. So we talk to that person, we talk to others, we pray, and we do it. And in some of my initial amends, there were some things that I wanted to make amends to my sister about, my twin sister about. And the first woman that took me through the steps saw this stuff on this list, and she was kind of like, I don't know about this. This might be that, when to do so would injure others kind of clause. But I insisted, because this was about me feeling better, right? Not about anything for my sister, not about making right the wrong. I insisted, and she said to me, why do you think you should go? And I gave her like 10 points, why I should make these amends to my sister, why it was absolutely necessary to do it. Nobody else was involved, but I point out this part because it really talks to us about consulting with others. We don't just come up with our list and go and do this stuff. We really have to check it out with others. What's my motive, And at the time, I didn't know, but now I know my motive was for me to feel better, to get something off my chest. Well, I went to her and said the way that I remembered it, and then she told me the way that it really was, And I went too early. I went without consulting others, and I did so much more harm to that relationship than had already been done. I did harm in sobriety trying to make amends to somebody because I didn't really counsel with others. It was my will in that. It wasn't about God's will, maybe coming through my sponsor in words of wisdom. It was, what I wanted to do. So I would really, really strongly suggest that you counsel with others. So, jumping ahead again, I have to now go and make amends to my family and other friends. And I went to my dad. And one of my big resentments against him, it says in the book, we might not completely be rid of the resentment when we go, but we set that aside. God's not necessarily going to take all that away. We set that aside, we go to the person, and we're just there to clean up our side of the street. We're just there to own our part. So I still had a lot of unresolved stuff with my dad, and a big part of it being, he never said he loved us. I never felt that. The alcoholic destruction that he never acknowledged, a lot of pain there, but I didn't mention any of that stuff to him. A big thing for me was my dad never hugged us. So as a kid, I attached that to he doesn't love us, and as an adult, it was, he doesn't love me, and it was just a weird thing to me, the hug meant love, So when I had gone to my dad and got real honest about all of the stuff that I had done, and I said to him, how has this affected you, and is there anything you need to say to me? I thought he was going to start yelling at me because I was crying, and you don't cry in an alcoholic family. You don't show emotion, God forbid. I was ready for the, what are you crying for? You're so sensitive. There you go again. And instead, my dad, it talks about it in the book. It says 9 times out of 10, the miraculous happens. Page 78, 9 cases out of 10, the unexpected happens. Sometimes the man we are called upon admits his own fault. So feud of years standing melt away in an hour. So I went and just got totally honest with my dad, and it opened up the door for this man who went to AA for 3 years, hasn't had a drink in 18. I don't know much else about his program other than that. Started saying to me, you know, when I was growing up, I didn't really feel like people loved me. And when people hugged me, it's like the hair on the back of my neck stood up and I cringed. I didn't want people touching me. I didn't want people hugging me. And I'm thinking like, did you read my mind? Did you read my journal? You know, it was like an answer to these questions that I had. And then he told me, which I challenge anybody in this room not to identify with this statement, I experienced two emotions. He said, I experienced fear and I experienced anger. And my fear always turns to anger. Shazam, like another thing, you know, an explanation. I can't say in my observations of my father that that's changed much over the years, but he gave me the opportunity to understand him. You know, that when my dad appeared real angry and blaming, you know, now I know that underneath all that stuff is fear. So I just walked away from that like, wow, you know, wow. I mean, my dad said this stuff to me and it was just unbelievable. Years of pain healed in that moment. And that was about me going to make amends to him. And that happened. So that was the beginning of a lot of healing with my father, and that was, you know, 6 years ago that happened. And over the years with my father, there's been a lot of challenges, you know, but I learned how to have a relationship with him. I learned not to be, you know, walking on eggshells, but I learned to keep my mouth shut. I learned that I didn't need to be right. I learned in what my father told me that he was uncomfortable with emotion stuff. I'm a social worker. Like, come on, you know, warm, fuzzy stuff. That's what we do. Let's talk about emotions, and then we'll write a song about it, and then we can, you know, hold hands and pray about it. I mean, that's me. I'm just very out there with my emotions, a very, very loving person. But that can be off-putting to people, and it was off-putting to my family, and I learned that in going through the work. They weren't comfortable with that, and I had to stop forcing that on them and expecting them, you know, to give that back to me because they didn't have the ability to do that. And making amends to my dad made me see that. So little by little over the years, these silly things would happen. Like my father would write in a card, you know, I love you. I'd be like, whoa, you know, where'd that come from? And we learned this little language with each other to talk about, you know, in a fight one time, he yelled at me, you know, if you're looking for wind chimes and butterflies, you're not going to get them from me. Like he screamed that at me, you know. Well, now my dad will say to me, I'm listening to the wind chimes and seeing the butterflies. He'll give me AA sobriety cards and draw little butterflies in it, you know. This is my alcoholic, unfeeling, don't hug me because I'm going to puke father, you know, who's slowly kind of doing that stuff. And what I think is most interesting about it is I don't need it now. You know, I don't need the butterflies now, you know, but it makes it really cool. It makes it really, really special. And the first time I heard my father say he was proud of me was at one of my celebrations, you know. Now, I had gotten a master's degree. I was valedictorian. I used to win spelling bees all the time. I had all these spelling bee awards, you know, and I never heard my father say he was proud of me until he gave me a coin at a celebration, you know. My uncle died, it's a couple years ago now, and my dad, he had lost two brothers in like a year and a half, and, you know, I was standing at the wake, and I saw him by the casket, and he sobbed, and I'd never really seen my dad cry. Drunk once, I saw him cry when another uncle of mine had died, and, oh my God, he was in so much pain, and I just wanted to be there for him, but again, I stepped back, because I knew I'm not going to force myself on him, you know, and by the end of that service that day, I went up to, just walked over to him, and he literally just kind of collapsed and started sobbing and wrapped his arms around me and just cried like a baby on my shoulder. And I just trust that I was put in the right place at the right time for that to happen, that it's not like my dad picked me or anything. It happened that way, you know. But what an amazing experience to just be there for my dad and, like, hold him, you know, and hug him and have that be okay. He still doesn't hug me, and I don't expect him to, but he hugs my nieces and my nephews, and that's really cool. I got married in September. I should say, the guy that I was with that came into my life after the alcoholic drug addict that I was with for about 8 months and then broke up with, When I went through that work with my new sponsor, she told me, you're going to go make amends to this guy. I'm like, why? Like, he broke up with me. Why would I make amends to him? And I was making amends to him because I made him my God. I put him on a pedestal. I expected him to make me feel better. And I had no business being in that relationship. You know, there was a lot of things. I tried to control him. I tried to change him. All those things. I went to that guy and made amends to him, and it, you know, like I healed from that breakup. Like I stopped, you know, obsessing about this guy. And what I thought was very neat was this man said to me when I said to him, you know, anything you need to say to me, he said, thanks for not making me look like a jerk. But that wasn't the word he used. He used an expletive. Because it was, you know, an in-the-rooms relationship, and I could have very easily gone to meetings and just, you know, slammed his name all over the place, and I was in so much pain, I didn't want to talk about it to anybody. I didn't realize in the long run that that would have worked out too, because it didn't harm that relationship more with this guy. And he came back into my life in 2003. God placed him back in my life, and I just married him on September 8th. And we're actually expecting already our first and second children. I'm pregnant with twins. Like an alcoholic, I can't just have one. I have two dogs. I have two cats. I'm going to have two babies. It's such a blessing. It's amazing. But anyway, I got married back in September, and leading up to it, I was spending a lot of time with my parents, which was becoming a real challenge with my dad. And I started talking to my sponsor a lot about it. And, you know, I could see, yeah, he's in fear, so, you know, he's got to control. My father, the badge he wears is he plays devil's advocate. I'm the girl that wears the rose-colored glasses, and my dad plays devil's advocate. So you can see that in a lot of situations that doesn't necessarily work out to our harmonious conversation. It was really, really challenging, and I was calling my sponsor, and God love her, she was ready to just, my plan was I was going to go live with my parents for 2 weeks before I got married, because I was living with my fiancé. I'm going to live with my parents so that it's like, you know, I'm going from my parents' house to my husband's house, which seemed silly at the time. Well, 2 weeks turned into maybe I'll go for a week, and then a week turned into maybe I'll go for 3 days, and then my mother finally said to me, why don't you just come after the rehearsal dinner, you know, stay over the night before, because she could see that things were not going well, and I was just keeping my mouth shut, and it was so hard to keep my mouth shut when you're just getting like, you know, being, someone's just kind of constantly prodding you. My sponsor was ready to pick me up, get a hotel room, you know, get me a massage, fill it with flowers, and spend the couple of nights before my wedding, you know, with me, because she wanted that to be such a special time in my life. And unfortunately, my father's fear or anxiety or whatever was just getting the best of him. And I ended up really praying. I had a plan. My plan was sleep a lot when I was there by my parents and not spend a lot of time. And well, the wedding day comes, and I'm dancing with my dad, and by the way, it was Somewhere Over the Rainbow was the song, of course, because it had to be something like Butterfly-y, and it was a doo-wop version, though, too, which he likes that kind of stuff. And my father said to me, and the reason why I'm sharing all this stuff is it's like you do the amends so long ago, and it just slowly, the relationships change. My father whispered in my ear, I never knew how confident you really were. You know, and I was like, whoa, you know, here I am 32 years old at my wedding, and my father sees the woman that God has turned me into as a result of the steps. And that was really, really a cool thing. It says in the book, it talks about on page 82, the problems in the home. You know, stopping drinking is just only, you know, a beginning. It talks about the alcoholic being a tornado roaring their way through the lives of other people. Tornado comes, we roar our way through, and then we open up the doors and we're like, hey, it's pretty calm now, right? Everything's okay. Like, I stopped drinking now and everything's going to be okay. But it suggests that we take another look at it. And on page 83, it says, there is a long period of reconstruction ahead. We must take the lead. A remorseful mumbling that we are sorry won't fit the bill at all. The next paragraph says, the spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. We have to live it. So with my family, I had to live it, and it took years, you know, with my dad of living it to slowly, you know, heal those relationships. talks about some wrongs we can never fully right. And it says at the bottom, we should be sensible, tactful, considerate, and humble without being servile or scraping, without being submissive or harsh. As God's people, we stand on our feet. We don't crawl before anyone. I'll talk about that in just a minute. But the other thing with my sister, my twin sister, who wanted nothing to do with me, didn't want to talk to me. In her wedding, she got married when I was sober 6 months. It was October of 99 when she got married, and she didn't even want me in her bridal party. She pretty much told me she was just doing it because everybody expected her to. They expected her twin sister to stand up next to her. A couple years later, she was pregnant and had my nephew and still really was kind of meh about our relationship. But she let me in. She let me begin a relationship with my nephew, who is now 4. And she didn't ask me to be the godmother. I certainly didn't expect her to ask me. I knew what I had done. I knew the truth in our relationship. When I had gone the second time around to make amends to her, she didn't want to hear it. She was one of those people that said, nope, I don't want to hear it. She finally sent me an email one day that said, forgive and forget, move on, what's done is done, I don't want to hear it. And again, I didn't force anything on her because she was uncomfortable hearing whatever I had to say. I guess it was just, you know, too painful for her. And instead, I just quietly showed up in the life of my nephew and quietly showed up in my sister's life. And there was a big family uproar because she hadn't asked me to be the godmother. But again, I didn't expect it. You know, I didn't expect it. And a couple years later, she said to me, actually, we were at a concert and she had a couple of beers, which puts her in a good mood to be able to talk about tough stuff. Sound familiar? And she said to me, she's like, I don't want to talk about this at all, but there's just something I need to tell you. I was like, okay, right? Because she knows me. She knows that I'm going to want to do the talking and the processing and the hand-holding, and let's write a poem about it. Take a picture, because it's a great moment. She said to me, I totally regret not asking you to be Liam's godmother. And that was it. And I didn't need to talk about it, you know, because it was like, it doesn't matter. You know, she, in that moment, to me, it was acknowledgement that she recognized that I had changed. You know, that I no longer embarrassed her or made her feel ashamed, that I was somebody that she would have been proud to have called a godmother to her son. That relationship continues to kind of go up and down. My sister's much better text messaging and emailing than anything, you know, and so I respect that. I totally respect that. It makes for some quiet gatherings, but that's okay. You know, again, I'm not going to force myself on them to have my needs met. It's about how I can be of service to them. And my sponsor and I were talking tonight just about there's stuff going on with her. You know, I know that she probably could benefit from a 12-step recovery program. And I mean, anybody can, but I think that my sister particularly can. And my sponsor came up with a really creative way of maybe trying to get her to go to Al-Anon, so I'm going to give that a shot. My other brother, the cop brother that I constantly lied to, slowly, you know, just in the last couple years, like he calls me just to say hi. Hey, what's going on? How's it going? And I'm still kind of like shocked by that because my siblings wouldn't invite me. They would do things together. They wouldn't invite me. They went on a cruise one time and they told me, you're not invited, you know, and they wanted nothing to, I was ready to book my flight and my brother Tom called me up and said, this is, you're not invited. I was devastated, like, oh my God. They wanted nothing to do with me. I was an embarrassment, you know. I'd end up like peeing my pants on the deck or something, you know, like entering into the belly flop contest. You know, I would have been crazy, which my brother won, by the way. But this one brother in October, we had come home from the honeymoon, and another nephew was born in July, and my brother called me up and said, you know, would you do us the honor of being his godmother? And that was like huge. It was so amazing. To me, that's it's such an honor. I'm involved in my church, and that's something that's important to me. It's not a part of the program. It's just something that's always been important to me. And you know, this was a guy that used to drive around looking for my car, calling up the bars, you know, and just never could believe a word that I said. And now he trusts that I will spiritually guide his son for the rest of his life. You know, and that's just a gift. That's just grace. That's the program. I have absolutely nothing, you know, to do with that. And then my final brother, who's actually my oldest brother, who just wouldn't say a word to me. This guy, it's like I didn't even exist. You know, he's been going through this over the last couple of years, but we've just found out since November that my sister-in-law is, had been arrested and was addicted to some substances, and my brother finally started getting honest with all of us about what was going on. And of course, my initial reaction was like, I'm the social worker in recovery. Like, you think they would call me to help them out? I had some, like, self-justified anger. Not even anger, just, like, questions about that. There they go again, excluding me. Like, my victim will come up, you know, when my sister-in-law is in jail, you know. Like, they're not calling me. But that quickly left. And, you know, I reached out to my brother. And I prayed about it, and I did what I could do for him, and didn't expect him to call me, didn't expect him to share anything that was going on with my sister-in-law, with me. Tried to be there for my sister-in-law. She's not necessarily accepting any help at this point. Had some numbers lined up, and that, you know, that just didn't work out. But my brother started calling me and asking me and talking to me about this stuff. And it just, this was a brother that I don't even know that he had my phone number, you know. And, you know, just over the years he started calling me. And again, I have to kind of mute myself with my family. I know that might sound weird, and it might sound like I'm not really being myself, but myself is a little too much for them, you know. What's the word I'm looking for? I don't compromise myself or my values or anything, but I just have to tone down my personality a little bit when I'm around them, and I'm okay with that. And, you know, he's been calling, and he's been talking, and, you know, my niece is 7 now, and I've always wanted to be a part of her life. Now I see why there was no return phone calls and things like that. And, you know, she spent the weekend with me because my brother needed a hand, and he called me yesterday. I had some concerns about my niece's, a possible learning disability or something, dyslexia, just from helping her with homework this weekend. But I wasn't going to say anything to my brother because I'm not. His thing was always like, she thinks she knows everything, like the social worker that works with kids, you know. And I used to be insulted by that because I felt like I've got experience doing this. But anyway, I laid back. I mentioned something to my mom briefly, like, you might want to mention it to Tommy. And as God would have it, he calls me yesterday and he's like, I need to talk to you. The school called me. They want to refer her for child study team evaluation, you know? And I was like, you know, and I wanted to see what you thought about that. And I told him what I thought about it. I said, I think it's a really good idea, and, you know, kind of went into that. And then this just blew me away. You know, having grown up in this family where you don't talk about feelings, you don't talk about emotions, you shut it up, you just avoid it. Especially my oldest brother. He was, if anything, brutally honest, you know, would lose friends because he'd tell you that haircut looks terrible on you. You know, he didn't care who you were. And he acknowledged how much he appreciated family right now at this time in his life. My sister, me, my parents, you know, and kind of had this moment where I just listened to him talking about kind of the silver lining, you know, in the dark cloud, if you will. And I said to him, you know, you've been a really great dad too. You've been showing up, and that's really important. So these amends that I made years ago, you know, it continues to reap benefits in my life as I continue to work this program. I've done recent 9 steps in the last year. One was to my now husband because I used to control him about the money situation and his financial irresponsibility. And then when I finally got honest with my sponsor about it, the truth was that I would, like, go shopping and hide the bags and sneak them into the house, you know. And then I'd scream and yell at him because we didn't have enough money to pay the bills. So I had to make amends for that, you know, and the moment I did that, the moment the onus came on me to be financially responsible, doesn't matter. Well, of course it matters in a financial partnership. And with my sponsor's encouragement, it was suggested that we look at it like a business, right? A business that doesn't do regular accounting, kind of goes broke, and it's like it's the business part of our relationship. We sit down with the bills and we pay them, and I had to get honest with that. And a real difficult one for me was amends that I had to make to a group that I had started. And my perception was things needed to get done, and there weren't people that, for whatever reason, were able to do it. And then I kind of heard that it slammed me in the face. Somebody told me that, you know, the group's really not happy. They're calling me a control freak. And there were some things that had been said that just were not truth. But it doesn't matter. It was said. And I had to say to the group, I talked to my sponsor about it, really sad, really upset. And she said, well, you know, 10 people can't be wrong. What's your part? Look at it. And what I saw was that my intention, my good intention to keep a meeting going when founding members had kind of moved on in their lives for the time being, did come across as controlling. My doing everything for everybody kept other people from stepping up into a position of ownership, from taking ownership of the group and being able to feel a part of. So again, at the time, it was good intentions. It wasn't intentionally harmful. It wasn't something that I meant to do. It was something that I thought I was doing to be of service to people. And when it was pointed out to me and I could finally step back and look at it, I made amends to the entire group. And I said to everybody, not like in the meeting, like before the meeting, does anybody have anything they want to say? You know, I hate when that happens, but it was during a business meeting, a group conscience, just the group members were there. And I said to them, if anybody has anything that they want to say to me, please do so. One person, two people came up to me and pretty much told me, yeah, we hated you, and which was really hard for me to hear, really hard for me to hear, because my intention was just, we had started that meeting in my basement, and it was to keep it going. You know, that was it. That was really humbling to do that, and then kind of what I did was I totally stepped back the other way. Like, I became the coffee maker. That's how I was going to be a part of that meeting. I wouldn't, you know, do the booking anymore. I was no longer, you know, the secretary. Somebody else took the money, and I let people, you know, feel ownership in that meeting, and the meeting, you know, has only grown since that point. And, you know, I was the coffee maker for 3 months, and if my situation allows me, maybe next time I'll be the greeter. I'll do the grunt work that nobody else maybe wants to do instead of, you know. Again, that was a really humbling experience. And the amends part of this work has truly made me so free. And the journey that I've experienced over the last 7.5 years, it's just, you know, they say the things like beyond your wildest dreams and all that stuff, but oh my God, if you knew me then, maybe I gave you a little glimpse about that. And you could be in my life now. I don't wake up with a hole in my soul anymore, you know. I can look people in the eye. I'm a part of life. God has done amazing things for me in my recovery, before my recovery too. Being brought into AA was just one of those amazing things that God did in my life, and it really, really amazes me the spiritual growth that's happened, that I do not react in any way, shape, or form to life now the way that I did. I was the psycho girl, you know. I used to physically harm myself, other people. It was crazy. I was crazy. My therapist in outpatient rehab said that I belonged in the back end of the loony bin in the straitjacket. You know, that's where I was. And now I am so far from that. Only because of working this program. And my relationships have only healed because of those amends and continuing to kind of do what I can do. And, you know, our job now is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and others. And that's the only thing I ask. You know, and sometimes I falter. I mean, there's people that I've made amends to that the relationship just hasn't gotten better. Just recently I finally had to say, I don't need to have a relationship with this person. It's just too difficult. You know, we just can't make it work. And, you know, it's not all perfect. I'm not all Pollyanna. But we get to work on this stuff, you know. We get to make our lives better. We get to show up and be of service and maybe in the process help another alcoholic, which is always an amazing thing too. So I hope it brought you some kind of message, and I'm grateful to be here as always at the group that led me to the solution. So that's all I have. Thanks.
Questions, sharing?
Thank you. It's funny, as Mary Beth was saying, that the freedom and the easygoingness, and I remember when I had made amends to that boyfriend that I'm now, my now husband, that was what the feedback was to me, because I was like, I can think about him and not cry, you know, and it was the power of the attachment is like, it's broken. And after I did that amends with my group, a big thing for me was, what do people think of me? And that was a big part of it. Like, what are people in AA saying about me? And after I did that, it's like, I don't care anymore. I don't care. As long as I know that I'm not intentionally doing harm to myself or other people, it doesn't matter to me. It matters what God thinks of me. It matters what my husband thinks of me. So yeah, that's neat. Easy going. I like that phrase.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Hi, Greg.
Rich. Wow.
It's almost 50 years old.
Wow.
So
that's synchronicity. That's like nice.
My father and his four siblings were raised in Norfolk from the age of 6 to about 13. And a German Catholic orphanage.
Mm.
And when you talk about being, hugs, not being part of their physical vocabulary, I remember my aunt's funeral. She's a nun. And I went up to my cousin. I had been in AA and NA for a couple of years. I went up to my cousin and gave him a hug. And it felt like I was hugging a tree.
Yeah.
He just, like, freaked. And just got real rigid. And I know where that comes from. Absolutely. I think I shook hands in my life. My father and my mother twice. And that was about the only physical contact I can remember other than when I was a little kid. And I would sit on his lap at a very young age. When you mentioned your amends here, I had to blank that and you didn't say it. You had financial amends to your mother,
mm-hmm.
and your father.
Mm-hmm.
How did you go about making them?
I just started paying them what I could pay them, and then actually at work, this was wonderful. We had contracts hadn't been resolved. It was a union thing, and so when they finally resolved the contracts, there was retro pay that came, and it was like $10 less than the money I owed my parents. So I took that check, and I handed it over to them, and I was free. When you can pay off financial debt, oh, isn't that the best feeling, to just be free of that? So I made payments to them. My father didn't want to take it. I made the payments to my mother. It was her first car ever. She and my dad had separated at one point. When they separated, she went out and took a loan out on a car, and she paid it off. And a year later, I totaled it. There was a lot riding on that one. So, yeah, I made payments.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
True,
yes.
Right.
I like that. I send my dad hugs now. I'll say to my nieces and nephews, like, go give Pop a hug, you know, and they'll run up to him and give him a hug. And the one time he said, that was from Aunt Rachel, wasn't that? You know, so that's the way I send my dad hugs now, because he'll hug the little ones. Ooh, he loves those little ones. He's such a good grandpa. He's an awesome grandpa.
Well,